Ladies and gentlemen, it's lovely to be here in this programme, which is very simply called That Reminds Me. And something that has happened to me so many times before when I've been in front of a BBC microphone, and I've been in front of quite a lot of them. My mind immediately goes back to the first time I was in front of a BBC microphone, which in fact changed the course of events for me, because I was in a little summer show at Galston near Yarmouth, and I was terrible. I mean, I'd got into it because I'd written a bit of stuff for a review in town, and I'd taken part in the review, and I was a window cleaner at that time, so I'd went out window cleaning in the morning, you know, early, and then did this review for a fortnight in the evening. I mean, I didn't know. I only got into it because I'd written some material and somebody was not well, and I went in to this review, not really doing very much except the bits of material that I'd written. Beryl Reid was the star. But I came out of that, having done that, and I had no thought about going into the business, this entertainment business. I'd just done it as a bit of a giggle, really, you know. But about a few months later, it rather got to me. And I thought, I don't know, I'd like to have a go at this. I'm getting bored of the window cleaning. I've been with the window cleaning business for about 5 years then. And it was marvellous, all around the West End here. Marvellous, cleaning the windows, doing quite well too, financially. Not bad at all. Oh, yes, well, a lot of new buildings going up, you know, that have been bombed, you see. This is late 40s and early 50s. And so I was quite happy with life. But then I spoke to my cousin, John Pertwee, and I said, look, I think I might have a go at this. He said, well, you can't do anything. He said, you can't. I mean, what are you going to do? So I said, well, I don't know, really. He said, well, you better have to start at the bottom. You better find yourself somebody who'll book you into a summer show or a repertory company, but don't tell him you can't do anything because it might hamper the, you know, things. So I said, oh, all right. But eventually I did find somebody who said, yes, I can book you into a small summer show at Galston near Yarmouth. Marvellous. I think I got £9 a week, which I thought was not bad. Nothing like I've been earning the window cleaning business. I mean, you know, nothing like it at all. But I thought, this is show business. This is what it's all about. And as I say, I couldn't dance, I couldn't sing, I couldn't tell a joke properly at all, and I couldn't really play in any sketches. So naturally, this small company of seven people got the needle and said, you know, he's not pulling his weight, this fella. I mean, we can't carry a passenger like this. And so they said, he'll have to go. So they spoke to the governor, who was also the principal singer in the show and box office manager and so forth. He said, look, at this time of the season, I won't be able to get anybody as cheap. And he said, and he fits the costumes. See? And he does make a nice cup of tea, so he's staying. Well, they sort of took me under their wing, and the marvellous principal comic, he, a lovely bloke called Clifford Hensley, he was wonderful. He used to come on, and he said to me, now, we've got five changes of programme, here are the sketches we're going to do, and he produced a tiny piece of paper about that size, and say, that's the first sketch we're doing. And I said, well, what's that then? He said, well, don't have to worry. He said, I'll come on, you see, and I'm undressing at the side of the stage because I'm going to meet the mayor. And all you've got to say is, Cliff will be here in a minute. He's going to meet the mayor. He's got to go up the alabaster balustrade. That's all you've got to say. Every time I disappear to take clothes off or put some clothes on because I've got to dress for this occasion, you say, he won't be here in a minute. He's just going to meet the mayor up the alabaster balustrade. I said, yes, I see, yes, righto. And, of course, it worked. It was amazing. I mean, he used to come on and say, I shall be a minute, dear. They're all right. Yes, I've got the trousers on now. And he'd come on with the terrible vest and long johns or whatever it was. And he'd do this, and he'd get a laugh every time. And all I had to say, it won't be a minute. I've got to go to meet the mayor up the alabaster balustrade. And I said to him, when we were rehearsing this, and I said, well, I think I've got it. Supposing I forget it. He said, oh, don't worry about that. You cover it up with a cough. I said, what? He said, you go, and he said, they won't notice. He said, they don't notice anything. He said, they're half asleep anyway, most of the audience. I said, oh, all right. And that was the first thing, cover it up with a cough. I thought it was a marvellous thing to tell anybody. You know, that's sort of started my training. Cover it up with a cough. Never forgotten that. So this progressed, and it was great. It was a marvellous season. The sun was out, and I swam a lot and played tennis and so forth. Lovely people in Yarmouth. I got to know the Beverly Sisters and Charlie Chester. And we then, during the summer, And this is where the turning point came. I'd been, before that, I'd been to the BBC and took a tape and said, you know, perhaps, would it be possible? No, this is, you know, go away. At the Aeolian Hall, this was, and I used to sit on the steps there, like a beggar, with a tape saying, anybody like to listen to a tape? You know, and they'd all go in, and disappear inside, and I'd, oh, thank you very much. Anyway, I get then this enormous opportunity because they're going to do this seaside special and they wanted to include a small excerpt from our summer show. Now, by that time, I was doing a few impressions to get me out of trouble, because if you said to the audience, I'm going to do an impression now of Frankie Howard, it didn't have to be very good. You told them it was Frankie Howard and they'd applaud at the end of it. I'd learnt that. Anyway, so I did a few impressions. I got a call about 2 days later from a BBC producer called Bill Worsley. And he said, when do you finish your season? So I said, well, in September. He said, when you get back, give me a call. And he said, I'll fix you up a midday music hall. That was my first broadcast. So I've never forgotten. And I've got a picture of that big BBC microphone with several of us around it, and that is a really treasured possession, because that was the start of my radio career. And from then on, it's been sort of a bit of luck, to be honest with you, because I still can't sing and I still can't dance. But eventually I got some stuff together and I went out in Variety as an impressionist, doing impressions of people like Rob Wilton, you know. The day I joined the Home Guard, my missus said to me, she said, what are you? Well, I said, I'm one of the Home Guard. She said, what are you supposed to do? Well, I said, I've got to stop Hitler's army from landing. She said, well, just you. I said, oh, no, there's Addy, Dave, there's Charlie. Well, there's seven or eight of us all together. She said, do you know this fella Hitler? I said, no. She said, well, how will you know if it's him if he lands? I said, well, I've got a tongue in my head, haven't I? All those sort of silly things. You know. And I used to do a bit of Frankie Howard, you know. Yes, ha-ha, yes, no, don't laugh, no. Anyway, I'm not being well, you've had this cold, you see, and I lost my voice, yes, lost my voice, yes, yes. And so I see the doctor, he said, right, Mr. Howard, he said, come in, he said, I want you to take all your clothes off, all your clothes, I'll go in the next room. Well, I went in the next room, and there's another fellow in there, not a stitchy. Stitchy-less, yes, stitchy-less. Anyway, I go in, you see, and I said, yes, that's a funny thing. I've only lost my voice, and the doctor's told me to take all my clothes off. And he said, it was a funny thing, because he said, I only came here to read the meter, and he said, I've lost a lot as well. Then I did a racing commentary with different voices. I didn't do a bit, but a great commentator was Raymond Glendenning. I don't know whether anybody remembers Raymond, who was a great boxing commentator, football, racing. And I did this thing, which was a racing commentary. When you didn't have the starting tapes, then you had just the flag that went up, you know, and this one sounded a bit like this. This is Raymond Glendenning saying hello and a very good afternoon to you from Sandown Park, where we have a high-class field running for the big race of the day, which is run over 7 furlongs for the cookery plate. Now, the runners are all down at the start there. There's Captain Crumpet calling the roll. The white flag is up, and they're off there, and first to show ahead in the 7 furlong cookery plate is Windsor Soup, followed by Roast Beef, Bob Pretends Against Rail and Lee. There comes green peas, apple pie, and custard coffee, and finally indigestion coming up on the inside now. But it's still Windsor Soup, roast beef, and boiled potatoes making the pace there. And with just in a furlong on, over to my colleague Michael O'Hare. And I say, can I pass me here? The order is still the same. It's Windsor Soup, roast beef, and boiled potatoes scoring very well indeed. Then comes green peas, apple pie, custard coffee, and finally indigestion's coming up there. But it's custard on the outside making the pace there. Custard right up on the outside now. And as they pass me here, they're into the last furlong now. And it's custard away. That is custard coffee and roast beef going very well indeed. And going very, and as they pass the post, it's as I thought. Why beef has won it from apricot flour. And indigestion third. Something like that. don't really remember it all, but something like that. And so I went out in variety as an impressionist and worked with some of the great people like Jimmy James and Max Miller. I think he was one of the great front-class comedians, Max Miller. I mean, the audience loved him long before he came on. And I used to say to him, you wait, don't you? You always wait. He said, yes, always wait for about 8 bars of music before I walk on. They're expecting me then, you see. Settles them down, and of course it was an amazing thing, because they were laughing before he came on. As soon as they heard that, as soon as they heard his music, you know, it was an amazing thing. And he had that marvellous voice, which is,
here's a funny thing. Now, I went home the other night, into the kitchen, through the hall, into the dining room, there was a bloke standing there, not a stitch on. Can you imagine that, lady? How's your memory, girl? Listen. I said to the wife, what's this? She said, keep your ear on, Miller. Don't lose your temper. He's a nudist coming to use the phone. Now, there's a clever one from the wife.
he was tremendous. Tremendous, Max was. And then things started to go with the variety theatres a wee bit. And what did they do? They put in the nudes. They thought, this will do it. We'll put in some nudes. And I went out in several of these shows. I mean, you can't mention all the names on radio, but I mean, they were like, we're taking off tonight and, you know, all tits and tinsel and things like that. No, no nudes are good nudes and all that sort of thing went on. In fact, they didn't tour the nudist ladies round with them. They used to go, the management used to go to the town beforehand. Like if you're playing Nottingham, they'd go into Marks and Spencer's and Boots. And the girls, they were only earning about £3 a week, and they used to say to the girls, would you like to earn another fiver next week? All you've got to do is to do a sort of semi-pose on the stage. You don't have to say anything. And that's all, about 3 minutes at night. Well, these girls, for £5, doing about 3 minutes at night, was better than all day in a shop for £3 a week, you see? And this is, I'm talking about the sort of latest 50s. And all they did was they had to sit on the stage, on a stool, then you'd have a compere on the side who would say, Doris is now in Paris. And the curtains would open and there would be Doris sitting on a stool with a beret on, as if she was in Paris. The curtains are closed again. Doris is now in Mexico. The curtains would open. They should have a Mexican hat on. The curtains would close again. Doris is now in Switzerland and she'd have a Swiss hat on. So that was it. And the girl could get up and go home and that was it. She'd, you know, do that every night. I was playing the West Bromwich Plaza. Ooh. Dear, oh dear. Water pouring down the walls in the dressing room and all that sort of thing. People in there and wrapped up in coats because it was, I think, early December. And this fella, who was the pianist in the show, but he also announced the girls, you see. And he's on about this. Gladys, I think her name was, we had on that week. He'd had a row with her. He'd had a big row. And he said, right, now, he said, tonight, he said, Gladys is in France, in Paris. The curtains had opened, and she did with the berry and that, and the curtains had gone. Now Gladys is in Mexico. Open up again. Gladys is now in Switzerland. Curtains are opening up, and that was the end of it. And as the curtains closed, he said, and by the way, during the day, Gladys can be seen behind the perfume counter in Boots in the High Street. Some of the digs, I mean, I'm sure that people have told you about some of the digs when you were touring in variety and you couldn't afford very much. It was 30 bob a week you wanted to pay. And that was for a sandwich at night and whatever. And I remember the first digs I had were in Leeds. I did quite a lot at Leeds because I was at the City Varieties early on and around there. And I got to these digs and she had a loo on the ground floor, one upstairs. One upstairs didn't work at all. And one of you had to use the ground floor. And I said to her, I said, dear, I can't make the loo. You know, it won't flush. She said, oh, Mr. Pope, you've got to surprise it. So I said, what do you mean surprise? Well, she said, you walk away and then give it a quick pull and it's fine. So now, that's it. So now I'm thinking, all right, I'll do that. So next time I go in, I've got to surprise it. So I'm just walking away, and it worked. couldn't understand it. But there are some, I mean, some dig stories that are quite horrendous. Arthur Askey actually told me one when he was staying in digs with a friend of his who was also on the bill. And they were sharing this room, two single beds, they were sharing the room because it was cheap, you know. And they had a bottle of sherry, which they brought in for the week. It was just to have something when they got back from the theatre, you know, with their sandwich. And suddenly this sherry started to go down. Right down, about half a bottle, in no time at all. A couple of days, they couldn't understand. They'd only had a little tiny drop. And they got a bit marked about this, and this fellow said to Arthur, he said, the landlady's knocking off our sherry, you know that, don't you? He said, I'm going to put a stop to that. He said, I'm going to wee in the bottle. Right, so it did, and the sherry still started going down. It was still going down right till the end of the week. Nothing left of it, hardly. So they're leaving on the Sunday morning, and the landlady said, well, I hope you've enjoyed the week, and I must apologise, but she said, you know, I've been taking a little of your sherry every day. They said, yes. Well, it was only to put in your trifle, that was all. But it is the characters in the business that I've loved, you know, so much. Someone that I did actually see once, and I thought, a tremendous admirer, I don't know why, I've always been of Noel Coward. Now, it's not, I'm not a very educated person, you know what I mean? But I just think he had so much to offer, that man. Wonderful, great sense of humour, wrote some lovely stuff and was a real man of the theatre. And I did see him and I actually followed him, believe it or not, down the Strand. I hadn't got the nerve to say to him, hello, or anything like that, of course. But there was one, I knew an actor who was in the lift with him, and an Australian lady got in, and Coward was in the lift, minding his own business, and this, apparently this lady said, oh, yeah, I know who you are. Oh, you wait till I tell him back home. Ha, ha, ha. I've seen the great Noel Coward. Yes, oh, very nice to meet you. Ha, ha, ha. You wait till I tell him back home. Go on. You're that writer, aren't you, as well? Ha, ha, ha. Well, go on, say something funny. There was a terrible pause, and Card said, Australia. Wonderful. The other great story, and I did meet Ralph Richardson two or three times, and he always had his wife with him then when she was alive, and he always introduced me as the man with the helmet. Well, this is the man with the helmet. And so I said, oh, yes, yes, we have met, yes. You've met the man with the helmet. Yes, yes, and I just said, oh, nice to see you again. Oh, good. And then when he used to say, I heard him actually say, well, I'm just going to say cheerio to the man with the helmet. That's all he said to him. It was an extraordinary thing. But he was in a play with two other actors, and after a fair time of this run of the play, they got into a little bit of a hiatus on the stage, and they didn't know where they were. And so there was this pause, and the prompt, in the prompt corner, said, whatever it was, couldn't hear it, and Richardson going out this, and he said, and a bit louder, whatever, and it got a bit louder, and Richardson eventually went over, and he said, we know what the line is, but who says it? Lovely, isn't it? It's lovely, wonderful stuff, wonderful stuff. And I suppose, quite by chance, that I said it earlier on about getting into plays, and I'd done a fair bit of radio, so I did know how to read a script, you know, because the radio had been very good to me. Dear old Leslie Bridgemont, who was a radio producer, he really got me into serious shows. Early on, I did about half a dozen of The Last Razor Laughs, which was wonderful. Met that marvellous bloke, Ted Ray, with that, you know, that terrific voice. I mean, he was just tremendous to listen to, and I used to keep my ears and eyes open, of course. And then I did a few Life of Bliss with George Cole, and then went into Meet the Huggets with Jack Warner. And Jack Warner used to say in the sort of when you're having a cup of coffee, if you can tell a joke in four lines, don't tell it in six. I learned something from everybody, and of course, from Kenneth Horne, obviously, as I think he was a great broadcaster, Kenneth Horne. And with when I got the chance of going into Beyond Arcane, we just got a flat, my wife and I just got a flat in Brighton. There was, I mean, really, you know, I used to say, oh, dear, we need a bit more lino here, we want a carpet or something. We hadn't got very little. And suddenly I get this, quite by chance, I am in the folder rolls at Eastbourne in the summer show, and for the weekend, coming down to Eastbourne for the weekend, Kenneth Horne, Jakes Brown was the producer, Kenneth Williams, they'd come down, and they decided to come and see the folder rolls. And I was doing a few voices, I only did only allowed to do 4 minutes as a solo performer in the Fol de Rols. And I got a call afterwards to say that we've done six Beyond Arkansas, of which I'd heard two or three of those, funnily enough. We're going to streamline the show and we want a utility man. And this is Jakes Brown. And we think you might be the person to do this. You may only have four lines 1 week or whatever it might be, but we'd like you to come up and see us. And so I did. And it was marvellous. I got into Beyond Arken. They gave me a contract for six. Now, we wanted some stuff for this new flat in Brighton. So I go to the bank manager and I took this BBC contract with me and I said, I've just secured a BBC contract. So he said, marvellous. I kept my hand over where it said 6 weeks. And I said, he said, how long is this going on for? I said, well, I mean, could go on for what, 20 years, I suppose? I don't know, no idea. I mean, so he said, oh, well, all right then. So lent some money and I went back and I said, right, we've got another roll of lino. And that has become a password in our family. You know, if a little check comes through the door for a repeat or something, there's another roll of lino has just come through the door. And so that was the Beyond I Came as the start, and then with, as I say, with Round the Horn. It was a marvellous time for me. I used to come up on the train from Brighton to the Paris Cinema. I didn't mind how, if I did two lines, three lines, or four lines, it didn't matter. Because I was just, it was a wonderful company of people to be with. And you could do one or two saucy things, which certainly you did in Round the Horn more so than Beyond I Ken. And people would not believe that they were saucy, because if Kenneth Horne was in the middle, he was the respectability of radio then. He'd done all sorts of things. And even if, you know, I mean, a lady in Tunbridge Wells would be listening, perhaps, she couldn't believe that Kenneth Horne would be associated with anything other than absolutely pure radio. That's why it was nobody took any offence, I don't think, anyway. Certainly wouldn't now, because it was rather tame as to some of the things that you can see on television now. But it was getting into Dad's Army that sort of turned everything around, I think. They were all actors there, you know, and I'd come in from the variety side of the business. And the reason I think David Croft wanted me to come into Dad's Army in the first place was that at least I could shout. He said, I just want you to speak pretty quickly and shout as loud as possible. That's the only criteria. And that was quite good, because I thought, well, I think I know how to do that. Don't know much about anything else, but I know how to do that. And there you had not just characters, but I mean eccentrics. I mean real eccentrics. You're being watched by 18 million people a week, and here they are at the breakfast table next morning. There's the poor floor manager, and he'd get us all together, all having our breakfast. There we had to get on the coach at 8 o'clock to go to the nearby location. And all you'd hear from Arthur Lowe was, I'm not ready yet. I haven't chosen what I'm going to have for breakfast. I know what I shall have this morning, I shall have the kippers. I don't want those awful things there, proper kipper. If not, I shall have some ham off the bone. And all this, and then, you know, he'd say, excuse me, boys, but we're ready to get on the coach, and never mind about all that coach business. Brown toast, and I don't want soggy brown toast, I want it nice and crisp. It's crisp. And all this would go on, you see, and John Laurie, of course, jumps out, hold on, I've only had one cup of tea, and that was cold. Arthur would keep on about certain things, and eventually, I mean, he'd get us all together. And then Arthur would then open his script, because we had envelopes, you know, for each day's filming, you see. Open the envelope. Arthur, you're first on this morning, really. What are we going to do then? But it says here, you're so-and-so. Oh, really? Oh, yes, well, yes, it'll be all right. I wonder what to have for breakfast, rolls in the van. You just had a breakfast, you're going to get some more breakfast when we got out there from the van. Some pretty nice sausages they had yesterday. Sausage and a bun was nice. You probably have no one of those this morning. I said, Arthur, have you looked at your script? Yes, very good, very good. Write very well, too. And, I mean, hadn't even looked at it, I don't think. And then, of course, the old theatrical experience would come in. He'd go behind the... Arthur, we're ready for you, I think. Yes, we'll be ready in about 5 minutes or two doing the lighting. I can see, I'm not silly. And he'd then start doing up his shoe at the last minute. At the same time, he'd look at his script and have a good look at it, because he knew that at the end of those five or six lines, they're going to have to change the lighting and the camera and so forth. So he didn't do it in the first six lines, you see. He was always very, very crafty. Very crafty he was. And I know that during rehearsals, when we got back into the studio, he had this boat he was restoring, lovely, beautiful steam yacht. And he used to bring in the plans for this and in the morning. And David'd say, right, I think we're half an hour late now in starting. So if we could start now, boys. And Arthur said, yes, just a moment. He said, I'm just showing the plans of my boat. Shan't be a moment. Yes, we haven't got long today because I think you're going off to do a commercial, aren't you? The voiceover is having this afternoon, Arthur. Arthur said, yes, quite right. I don't know where it is. But anyway, let's get back to the boat and this important thing. Well, so he'd start telling a bit. And David Croft would say, come along now. You were late this morning. What happens in the morning, Arthur? Why is it sometimes the bus doesn't run very well, the train? Yes, we don't live very far away. Couldn't you get a car? Oh, far too expensive. No. I can buy bus and underground. And he said, what's happened to your car? Oh, I couldn't deal with that. He said, kept running out of petrol. So he said, well, the cars do if you don't put any petrol in. Yes. Well, now, what are we going to do this morning? Well, Arthur, first of all, I want to say that you can't learn your lines in our rehearsal time. You cannot do that. It's not fair on everybody else. You must take the script home and learn them there, you see. Anyway, have I shown you my plans for the boat? Never mind about all that. He said, I tell you what, he said, I'm going to give you four scripts. He said, one you leave here, one you take on the bus, one you take on the underground, and the other one you take home. And Arthur said, take home? I wouldn't have that rubbish in my house. What could you say to the man? What could you? Nothing at all. But some of the great bonuses I've said in this business have been, I think, being able to play cricket and know some great cricket characters. I mean, it's marvellous, you see, being able to play charity cricket because they think I'm some sort of name. And so I played with Bill Edrich when he was alive and Dennis Compton, Peter May, Colin Cowdrey I've played with, and I've had a great time. I mean, really, really super. Fred Truman's a great mate of mine. And also the commentators. I did a View from the Boundary with Brian Johnson, which was wonderful, because we're supposed to do 20 minutes, and it was raining. And so we did about an hour and a half. It was Mao. We chatted about everything, and I ate his lunch by mistake. It didn't go down terribly well. But he's lovely, broke Brian. And, of course, John Arlott, who I got to know very well, spoke at a couple of dinners with him. And John was talking about when he used to do some early broadcasts. Now, I'm going to finish this little session on one which John apparently did on a ladies' cricket match. And I sort of just broadened it out a wee bit to sound something like this, I think. Well, this is John Arlott speaking to you now from the Oval. It's a beautiful day here. The sun's shining through the gasometer. I can see it now. And this is the match between the Lambeth ladies and the Battersea Bags. And now from the pavilion end, it's Fanny Adams to bowl to Nellie Dean. And Fanny's bowling with a slip and a petticoat high up, a backward short leg. And she bowls to Nellie, and Nellie, stretching a little extra the utmost, manages to smother the spin. She also manages to smother the wicket-keeper as Nellie weighs the best part of 19 stone. And now Fanny bowls again now, and she's bowling now with a slip farther up now. I think the slip has come up. Yes, it has. And she's bowling again. And there's been an appeal against the light. There's been an appeal against the light here from the from Nelly. And with that, I think they're going to abandon play for the day. So this is John Arlott saying goodbye to you from the Oval and returning you to the studio.